Good morning. This is the clerk of the court, Greg Block, confirming procedures for the oral argument scheduled to be conducted by teleconference this morning. If arguing counsel or a judge drops from this teleconference, we will pause the proceedings and clock until the judge and or counsel is reconnected. In accordance with the instructions we previously provided counsel, we will sound a single tone that sounds like this. If I have Dawn on the line, there we go, a single tone when counsel has 3 minutes. And we will sound a double tone that sounds like this when counsel's total allotted time expires. That's a double tone. Arguing counsel in this case are on the call. Mr. James Ridgway, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Thank you. And Ms. Shakeba Morad, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
And also Mr. Christopher Bader, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Thank you. Please stand by while I confirm the judges are on the call. Our presiding judge, Chief Judge Bartley, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear both counsel and you.
Thank you. And Judge Meredith, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
Yes, I heard both counsel and I can hear you.
Thank you. And finally, Judge Falvey, did you hear both counsel and can you hear me?
I did and I can.
Thank you. Chief Judge Bartley, the call is configured and all participants are now ready to proceed.
Very good. Colonel Block, you may call the court to order.
The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Margaret Bartley presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Judge Bartley, and I'm joined today via teleconference by Judge Meredith and Judge Falvey. We're here for the matter of Charlotte A. Bowling and Kevin D. Appling versus Robert L. Wilkie. Those are docket numbers 18-5263 and 19-602. And the issue before us, among other things, is whether to certify a class in this case and whether VA's insanity regulation, which is 38 CFR 3.354A, violates constitutional due process. Will counsel for the parties please state your name and your appearance for the record, beginning with appellant's counsel?
Good morning, Chief Judge Bartley and your honors. This is James Ridgway of Bergman & Moore for Mrs. Charlotte Bowling and Mr. Kevin Appling. And with me today in the conference room are Glenn Bergman and Tom Pulsino of Bergman & Moore.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Ridgway and Mr. Bergman and Mr. Pulsino. Secretary?
Good morning, your honors. Shakeba Murad for the secretary.
And Christopher Bader for the secretary, your honor, and with the two of us is Chris Wallace, deputy chief counsel.
Great. Welcome, Ms. Murad and Mr. Bader. And I understand that you are dividing your arguments.
Yes, your honors. I will be presenting the class action portion and will be taking up the first 10 minutes of the secretary's allotted time. And my colleague, Christopher Bader, will be taking the second 20 minutes of that time.
Okay, that will work for us. Each party will have 30 minutes total to present arguments. Mr. Ridgway, would you like to reserve any portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's fine. We'll make that happen. And Mr. Ridgway, you may proceed when you're ready. Preferably with argument as to class certification first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name again is James Ridgway. The appellants in this case challenge the validity of VA's insanity regulation. There are many threads to this case, but there are really three fundamental issues. Is VA's use of the current insanity standard wrong? What would it take to effectively remedy this wrong? And is there a justification for not trying to effectively remedy this wrong? The answers to those three questions are also straightforward. Yes, this standard is wrong because and violates due process because it does not provide fair notice to citizens seeking benefits that they have earned, and it allows for arbitrary decision-making by the agency. An effective remedy in this case requires not just invalidating that rule, but replacing it and re-adjudicating claims, because this is an unusual situation, if not unique, where the meaning of insanity has changed radically since when Congress first used it in 1945 in this purpose, and merely striking the regulation will not lead to Congress's desired result. And there's no prudential justification for not righting this wrong for the appellants here and for all similarly situated veterans. This is not a hard case where there are competing constitutional values or separation of powers concerns. On the merits, this is very simple. It's about service members who were promised that their nation would take care of them, and all they want to know is, what facts, what evidence do I need to present in order for the government to keep that promise? On the remedy, it is a highly unusual situation because of the nature of the insanity definition, but it is not hard to see what must be done in order to right this wrong. If we look first at the insanity or at the class action standard, we can see that even though appellants are arguing that the class certification here is needed not to resolve the merits, but in order to provide a remedy that fixes this for all similarly situated veterans, the requirements of class certification are met here. The number of potentially affected former service members is numerous. The precise size need not be defined, but it is clearly more than 40, and that is sufficient to meet that requirement. There is a common question of law, a single and discrete question that affects all class members. Is this standard valid? And if it is not, how can they get a remedy of a new adjudication under that standard? Eventually, the determinations on their individual cases will be unique to their own facts, but at that point, class supervision is no longer required. The claims
Mr. Ridgway, if we could just move on from the four class factors to something that I'm more interested in, which is, I guess it's two issues I have. One is I am uncertain that you have, you know, rebutted the presumption against class action or shown that class is more superior here. And in the SCORE case, we laid out some superiority factors, which are, of course, not exclusive, but those are things that we can typically look at. Now, talk to me about, in particular, the latter three of those, because I think we might all agree, or I hope another judge will interrupt me if they disagree, that the challenge here is collateral to a claim for benefits. So the other three, as you know, are the litigation involves compiling a complex factual record and moves on from there.
Yes, Your Honor. The claim here is collateral because it is about the standard. It is not about the application of that standard to any individual class member. Once a class member has received a new adjudication on the merits, their need for class participation ends. We are only asking for a remedy that goes through the provision of a new adjudication. At that point, each individual case becomes individual again, and any further dispute would be considered on an individual case-by-case factual basis.
Right, and as I said, I think, well, at least I agree that you have met that first factor, that it's collateral, but what about the others?
Moving on to the second problem about complexity. In that regard, this case is exactly like Wolf. It was not hard to see in Wolf that the regulation that VA had promulgated was invalid. You did not need a class to do that. What a class was needed for was the remedy stage, and administering an effective remedy is a complex problem because those people affected have to be identified and provided notice and then given the opportunity to have a new adjudication based upon the new standard that's provided. Turning to the next factor, the record here is sufficiently developed. This is, again, not about the facts of any individual case. Doing further adjudication on individual acts is an exercise in futility. And then the important part is we have alleged sufficient facts in order to show that remedial enforcement is appropriate. What the class members in this case need is for the VA to issue a new standard that provides them fair notice of how to prove their claims so that they have the opportunity for that development and then a re-adjudication under that standard. That can be seen with the information available to the court.
And so in your brief, that's a factor to the complexity issue. You seem to refer to the complexity somewhat of identifying class members and things like that. Is that something that you believe suffices for this superiority factor?
I do. And again, it is because this case is precisely like Wolf. It's not the merits problem of is this regulation valid that is complex and hard. In Wolf, the court said no. The VA clearly did something it was not permitted to do. And then the class issue was how do we administer a remedy for all of these people who have been denied a fair adjudication of their claims? How do we identify them, contact them, and make sure that they get their right to a new adjudication when VA has led them to believe that their claims have no merit and they should not be pursuing further relief from the agency? In practice, what this means is we have asked for a class going back to the origins of the 1993 regulation that the members of those class, and we know from Southie, as the court has cited, that this must include people who have applied for benefits. And VA has excellent data systems that capture historical information going back that far as to who has applied for benefits and what why they were denied. It's not completely granular, but we can tell who was denied for character of discharge, and we can tell by body system which type of claim they were pursuing, particularly whether it was a mental health claim that was originally filed. Now, there's a lot of VA computer systems, and it's not as simple as running just one query and then sending out everything. Our Bergman and Moore has particular expertise because of the number of former VA people who are at this firm with those computer systems and how the data is categorized to help make sure that we are searching for the right group of people and reasonably trying to send them letters that notify them what has happened and what they would need to submit under a new standard in order to give a re-adjudication where they have a fair opportunity to have the question heard as to whether or not the character of their discharge should be excused.
This is Judge Meredith. If the court were to find that the appellants have not demonstrated that the regulation is unconstitutional, what are the appellants asking the court to do with respect to the class motion?
If the appellants lose on the merits, then the class motion is moot because the class's motion is to administer the remedy.
Thank you.
As to the merits, it is clear that what is happening here is wrong. There are many ways to look at due process.
Mr. Ridgway?
Yes.
Hi, this is Judge Falvey. Before you move on to the merit, let me ask you another question about the class action. If we don't get through the threshold issue of whether or not you've shown that the class action is superior to a precedential decision, Is it necessary for us to delve into the Rule 23 factors at all?
I'm not sure I completely understood your meaning when you called it a threshold issue.
I guess you could disagree whether it's a threshold issue or not, but in accordance with SCORE, appellants have to show that a class action is superior to a precedential decision. And if we determine that you have not made that showing, do we need to even consider the Rule 23 factors like numerosity and et cetera?
I'm not sure that the factors have to be considered in any particular order or that any of them necessarily have to be considered threshold. The fundamental issue, as we are presenting it, is not do we need a class to determine that this regulation is wrong. It is what will it take in order to apply an effective remedy for all affected veterans. In this case, again, it is very similar to Wolf in that you can resolve the merits first and then get to the question of, as it was framed in SCORE, what is needed for this to be an effective force for institutional change that prevents the replication of mass wrongdoing? Or, in Monk, we have to compel correction of systemic error. That's what the Federal Circuit said in Monk. Class action is to compel correction of systemic error and to ensure that like veterans are treated alike. In this situation, an individual adjudication here will not correct systemic error and will not ensure that like veterans are treated alike because, as in Wolf, veterans who received fundamentally inaccurate letters and decisions are misled into believing their claims were hopeless. And as the court said in Wolf, it is critically important because if left uncorrected, these past claimants won't appeal or perhaps even continue with a claim. And so our argument here is that the class motion is the superior method of ensuring that the ultimate systemic error is corrected and that like veterans are treated alike.
Mr. Ridgway, this is Judge Bartley. I understand what you're saying, but that's probably the case with any time that the court considers invalidating a statute or a regulation, that some people would not hear about it and might be left behind. Being that could be so, such general applicability, is that a factor that we should consider as part of the presumption question or the superiority question?
I believe it is. I think you can look back to Niemer and say, well, Niemer could have fixed this without certifying a class and re-adjudicating 150,000 cases under Shinseki in order to make sure these veterans got what they were entitled to. We are not arguing that every single issue of interpretation merits a class action. This is an issue of due process, and whether these veterans got a fundamentally fair adjudication. And the Supreme Court, in other contexts, has been very circumspect about applying rules retroactively, but it explained in Teague v. Lane that a new rule should be applied retroactively if it requires the observance of those procedures that are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. We are asking no more than a holding that in the event that the court finds that a process was constitutionally defective because these applicants did not get due process, they were subjected to arbitrary decision-making, and they did not get the fair notice of how to prove their claims, in that circumstances, that value rises to one that should be enforced through a class action. If there's no other issues on that point, I want to focus on the merits at this point. This regulation violates due process. First and foremost, citizens are not given notice of what facts to prove in order to prevail. because this regulation uses language that is not comprehensible to a person of ordinary intelligence or even to one skilled in law and medicine who knows what insanity means today as a technical definition. If we look at how the Supreme Court in Johnson framed it, vagueness exists when there's a pervasive disagreement about the nature of the standard and the kinds of facts that are relevant. The regulation fails that test. In Ruiz, the Supreme Court said that standards must be generally known, and this fails that test. This also, when you look at it from the perspective of adjudication, this standard leads to arbitrary decision-making. In Yik Wo, the Supreme Court explained that a rule cannot allow for naked and arbitrary power to give or withhold a benefit, which is what we are seeing with the adjudication of these claims.
This is Judge Bartley. It occurred to me in looking over, I think we had several cases that were considered that involved 3.354 and where we had joint motions to remand and also where we had some single judge decisions pointing out errors that VA had made in these cases. Now, it wasn't clear to me that those errors, and that those could be just the tip of an iceberg, I have no idea, but those errors seemed to be, I think that was our bell. So, Dawn, please add another 10 minutes. Those errors seemed to be a function of the VA reading the regulation wrong, and there were also some instances of, you know, duty to assist problems and reasons or bases problems, but they didn't seem to be uniquely tied to the vagueness of the regulation. So can you explain to me why it's vague or unconstitutionally vague, I should say? Because, I mean, that implies, like, the absence of a standard. But when I look at the three points here listed in 3.354, it does have drafting problems, and it's a long sentence, and contains some clauses that, you know, maybe detract from the meaning. But I don't see that there's no standard there at all. I mean, if these are alternative bases, the three things listed here, to find insanity, it seems like you need to have a disease. And I'm assuming it's a mental disease, although, quite frankly, that's not totally clear, but I assume that. A disease that results in a more or less prolonged deviation from normal method of behavior. And then the second one would be a disease due to disease, one interferes with a piece of society or et cetera, and number three, so departed from accepted standards of the community. So I'm having trouble following your argument that these three factors are unconstitutionally vague. I mean, you and I may agree or disagree as to whether these are indicators of insanity, but the regulation says they are indicators of insanity. And so we're not talking here about whether we agree that these do show insanity.
Sure. This regulation is vague because it is unclear how it applies in the great majority of the cases where it needs to be applied. We're not talking about fuzziness at the edges or a little bit of a gray zone, which is normally tolerable. When we turn to the constitutional standard, the requirement to show vagueness is that people of ordinary intelligence cannot figure out how to prove their claims, and that it permits naked and arbitrary outcomes by people who are adjudicating these claims. And when we look at the facts on the ground, we can see that that standard is met. There are words here that you could imagine might have a standard meaning, but in practice, they don't. And so you can look at the Garbelman article by a VA psychologist where he admits that there is no training to explain these words and that they do not align with anything he as a professional psychiatrist understands as having a meaning from the DSM. When we align these words with the language of the DSM, it is not possible to trace a connection between these phrases and a standard that the court can enforce for clear error. OGC's attempt to save this regulation through a general counsel's opinion addresses the outcomes of only a small sliver of the cases involving a mental health standard. We know that active psychoses qualify for insanity and that personality disorders do not. But those represent only a tiny portion of how of the cases that have to be adjudicated. The court cases are the cases like that.
Mr. Ridgway, this is Judge Bartley. I understand what the GC opinion said as to a lot of this, but we're not bound by that GC opinion. That is, if someone said that you need to have a psychosis in order to meet the definition of insanity, do you believe that that is borne out by the words of the regulation?
I do not believe that that is borne out by the words of the regulation. I believe that was simply an attempt to provide something concrete that made this regulation feel less vague. When we look at the language of the regulation, we have words like the community by birth and nature that a person belongs to. I am a child of Air Force veterans, and I was born off base in Germany. What is the community by birth that I belong to? I mean, what does it mean to lack the adaptability to your current community? Which is the current community that's relevant? You can imagine meanings of these, but not that would be agreed upon in a way that gives citizens fair notice or gives adjudicators constraints that lead to consistent outcomes. We have former service members like Mr. Bowling who come home with PTSD. PTSD, the signature conflict of the current signature disability of the current conflict and also of the Vietnam War. And there is no predictability. There's no understanding as to how they hold the government to the promise to take care of them. Mr. Bowling had a professional psychologist who prepared an opinion that said he is not responsible for his AWOL because of his PTSD, and the board said, well, that's irrelevant because it didn't address this standard. Yet when we go back to what Congress intended in 1945 when it passed the GI Bill, it's clear that he was precisely the type of person that if you accept the basic facts that the board didn't because it focused on this insanity thing, that we meant to protect. We meant to care for people coming home from combat with PTSD, with TBI, who have problems that lead to unfavorable characters of discharge. People like the veteran described in Secretary Shulkin's book, who had six tours of duty in Iraq and then came home and went AWOL because his wife left him and he wanted to find her. These people.
This is Judge Meredith. Can I interrupt you there? You just referenced a book that you mentioned in some of your pleadings, so I wanted to ask you. You reference a lot of materials throughout your pleading, books, websites, YouTube video, that are not contained in the record of proceedings. Under what theory are you asking us to consider those materials, and do we have jurisdiction to do so?
Yes. The answer is that you have jurisdiction to do so, to take judicial notice of these things, because this is material that's relevant to general facts that's not subject to reasonable dispute. And so this is like AZ, where the Federal Circuit, in order to understand MST in the military, went outside the record to reports on MST and used those as the factual foundation of their holding, even though those reports were not in the record that was even before this court. On the other hand, when we look at what is not permissible under KINE, the example that we have is a situation where an individual veteran did not get scheduled for an examination, and the material submitted was an affidavit from an individual employee about the specific practices at the specific facility where this veteran was supposed to go at the specific time where this veteran was supposed to go. That type of individualized adjudicative information that would be appropriate for the board to consider is the type of thing that cannot be introduced to the court. However, the board lacks jurisdiction to declare statutes and regulations invalid. Presenting general information that comes from VA's own computer systems and data analysis done by respectable groups that subject them for peer review and provide citations, that is the type of material where it is futile to present that to the agency because there is nothing the agency can do with it to address the constitutional question. Of course, the court has remanded cases like SCORE to put things in the record and have the board to address them, but this isn't a case like SCORE where these adjudicative facts that are pertain to a small number of specific veterans. This is like AZ. This is like cases where the court has cited the Merck manual or the Federal Circuit has cited VA's own clinician guide. And so that is the line that we would draw.
And if we were to find, this is Judge Meredith, if we were to find that some or all of the materials you cited are not appropriate for judicial notice, what's the remaining support for your contention?
Well, if you were to find that it was not appropriate for judicial notice, then we would ask for a remand for the board to consider this in the first instance, even though such an action would be futile. It would merely delay fixing this harm. But I would ask the court to delve further into this and see that the information that's being presented, particularly from the underserved report, this is coming from VA's own data system. This is information that is clearly subject to judicial notice. When you read things like the Adams and Montalto argue, they're quoting from board decisions that use particular language. That is material that is clearly appropriate for the court to take notice of.
This is Judge Bartley. I believe I heard the bell. Let's add another 5 minutes here.
In this,
Mr. Ridgway, I was waiting for Judge Meredith, but she's finished with that question. You mentioned a few times, this is Judge Bartley again, you mentioned a few times about the words insane and insanity not really being used in medicine or psychology, psychiatry today, and that seems to be a running theme throughout your briefing. And that term may be outdated, but it's actually the statute. It's a term that's used in the statute 5303. So we can't escape it, right? I was unsure about what you were saying about insanity because although some of us may think that it is old-fashioned, it is still what Congress has used in defining it an exception to the willful and persistent misconduct, I believe. So what are your thoughts on that?
So our argument is not trying to escape the word insanity. Our argument is that we're in a unique situation where that word, because of the acquittal of John Hinckley, has come to have a radically different meaning than when Congress used it in 1945 to create this standard in the GI Bill. What we're asking for is as a proper textualist interpretation where we look to the meaning of the word that was contemporaneous when it was used by the legislature, and we enforce that meaning, even though words may have a different meaning today. When we look at the legislative history, we see when Congress used that language, they intended to care for people who came home from combat with PTSD or TBI, and because of their troubles, received unfavorable characters of discharge that did not negate the moral obligation to care for people who have borne the battle. People like Mr. Bowling, who served in combat, who witnessed death, who had to bag the body of one of his comrades, who was friends who was killed in a friendly fire incident. And then finishing out his tour, was unable to handle the situation, leaves, goes home to West Virginia, and then when the letter arrives saying, you have abandoned the military, you're in trouble, walks to the police station in his hometown and turns himself in. These are troubled people that are owed benefits. That is the intent of Congress when they use that word insanity. And so what we are asking is that we effectuate the will of Congress. And the will of Congress is relevant here because the fundamental question is this vague at the core or is this vague at the margin? And when we look at the will of Congress, we see this is vague at the core. PTSD allows people to be subject to arbitrary and inconsistent decision-making where many ROs have a 0% grant rate, but Boston, you know, you have a 30% grant rate. Salt Lake City, you know, comes close to that. If you, you know, play the adjudicator lottery at the board. Yes, Jeremy.
Excuse me. This is Judge Falvey. If this regulation is antiquated, have you petitioned VA to amend or repeal the regulation?
So we have not. It is questionable whether or not that would be possible. At the moment, you know, we are not within 6 years of the regulations enactment, so the statute of limitations for rulemaking actions has expired. So we certainly could not do that. And just because there may possibly be other paths to a remedy doesn't mean that this court lacks the authority in a case before it that presents a live case or controversy to do what is needed to fix this. That the existence of an alternative path for these former service members or anyone else is not a justification for not doing the right thing when the case or controversy is before the court, and the court has the authority to provide the remedy now to these appellants and to all similarly situated former service members.
In your textualist argument about Congress's use of the word insane, and then the Secretary's attempt to define what that means, it strikes me that the definition the Secretary has provided is broader than traditional notions of insanity, including post-Hinckley. And I'm not sure that veterans would necessarily benefit from a definition that more closely adheres to understandings of what that term means. So absent Congress changing the word that they use that provides an excuse for willful misconduct.
This is Judge Bartley. Let's add another 5 minutes.
It strikes me as a great risk to veterans that a narrower definition would limit this exception. Isn't that a risk? Unless we impose the definition that you want, if we leave it to the Secretary to come up with a better definition that more closely adheres to understandings of what the term insanity means, that's a risk that you're willing to accept?
I do not think that is a risk as to the language or as to the reality on the ground.
Hold on. In Gardner, the Secretary tried to graft onto the regulation notions of insanity found in the Model Penal Code and the UCMJ about understanding the nature and quality of your actions or being unable to control your behavior. And we said, no, the regulation doesn't provide for that. But if they put that in the regulation, the regulation would, in fact, provide for it. That would narrow the exception to a very small class of veterans. Right now, it seems to me that it's a very broad definition of insanity that allows at least the potential for a great number of veterans to benefit from it.
First, I would say that there is no evidence that veterans are benefiting from this. Indeed, the evidence is all to the contrary, that we have a large number of regional offices that have a 0% rate of excusing character of discharge and a large number of VLJs. When we look at the Adams and Montalto article, we see that the VLJs are applying this, you know, as a standard akin to the need for guardianship. It is not the case where a great many of former service members are being granted benefits, and they might not under a revised definition. There's always a chance that when an authority is revised by the agency, that it could be interpreted as being less favorable in some way, shape, or form. But when we look at the cost and benefits and the competing risks, the current risk is that large numbers of former service members with PTSD and TBI and other particularly combat-related conditions, and we're not arguing that it requires combat-related conditions. We're not. Indeed, we're not arguing for any specific definition. We are actually trying to respect the separation of powers and to say that VA ought to be given the first opportunity, and then that ought to be measured against the intent of Congress. I believe that any regulation that's measured against the intent of Congress will continue to provide benefits to those who are actively psychotic at the time of the events in service, as is clear from the general counsel's opinion.
This is Judge Falvey. If you wanted to honor the separation of powers, wouldn't you begin at Congress and say this rule that says insane needs to be modified to include other things? Like, you know, anyone who because they're insane or suffer a cognitive injury, have Congress flesh it out?
The possibility of Congress curing a constitutional error does not prevent the court from acting. We saw that just this week in how the Supreme Court interpreted the protections based upon sex. That's actually a statutory interpretation issue, but it could have been fixed by Congress. Congress can always fix it.
The Supreme Court didn't say, this is Title VII is unconstitutionally vague, therefore we're going to fix it. They said that it's perfectly clear and textual. That's to say what the term includes. Here, you're not making that argument. You're saying that the regulation to try to define the word insane provided in a congressional statute is impermissibly vague. The Supreme Court case this week has nothing to do with that.
I think this Supreme Court case is an example that the fact that an error of any type could be remedied by Congress is not a justification for the court refusing to remedy that error when it has a live case or controversy and the ability to remedy that error for the people before it. As the court said in SCORE, once the grant of the door to jurisdiction has been opened, the court can use its authority under the AWA and 7261 to fix errors. And so it is not appropriate.
This is Judge Bartley. Let's add another 5 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Our fundamental argument here is you have appellants before you who are harmed by this unconstitutional regulation. You have the power under 7261 with these folks to interpret the statutory provision at issue, to compel action of the secretary unlawfully withheld or unreasonably delayed, and to hold unlawful and set aside regulations that are contrary to constitutional rights. You have a live case or controversy where this remedy is needed, and you have the authority to provide the remedy. It is not a justification to say that somebody else could deal with this problem. As I said at the beginning, there are hard cases that raise separation of powers concerns and competing constitutional interests, but this is not one of them. This is not a case where striking down the regulation has collateral impacts on the democratic process that the court should want to avoid. This is not a case where we have to worry about whether or not this is going to open the door to the courts doing things that it is not appropriate for the courts to do. We cited to Niemer as an example of how class authority can be used effectively to remedy a widespread wrong for hundreds of thousands of veterans. And if we look back to the original Niemer orders in 1991, the court ordered VA to engage in rulemaking and said, you know, you have this many months for the advisory commission to prevent it, to present its recommendation, and by July 1st, 1991, VA, you must say what the new rule is. It may take longer to get through the rulemaking and turn it into a regulation, but the court set out a timetable for filling a needed gap with having the VA do that. And so we're not asking the court to step in and provide a regulation. We're not suggesting one. We are arguing that whatever regulation is provided or alternative form of rule, whether it's an M21 provision or an OGC provision to fill the gap until formally, it has to comply with the intent of Congress and the GI Bill. But we are trying to respect separation of powers by saying VA should have the first opportunity, and the court should compel VA to provide this quickly because it has been unlawfully withheld and unreasonably delayed. And then if the court, if VA does not act, then the court has the authority under A1 to interpret a statutory provision and say, you haven't acted promptly enough for these veterans, particularly the Vietnam veterans who are dying every day without getting justice. And so we're going to fill the gap. And that doesn't prevent the secretary from them providing a separate regulation. Under Brand X, if the court provides a definition of an ambiguous statute, the agency continues to have the authority to abrogate that interpretation through its own rulemaking. And we're only asking the court to go to that extreme if the VA does not provide an acceptable rule that complies with the intent of Congress within a reasonable amount of time so that the appellants like Mr. Appling and Mrs. Bowling can know what evidence they need to provide. What do they have to have their psychiatrist or psychologist address so that we don't have situations where the psychiatrist says he was not responsible for his actions because of his PTSD, and then VA says that doesn't matter because that's not our definition of insanity.
This is Judge Meredith. If I could, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about the specific two appeals that we have in front of us. In the Bowling case, as you know, the veteran actually had an earlier period of service that was not a bar to benefits. So the board adjudicated and denied 13 claims for various disabilities based on that first period of service. Your arguments have to do with his second period of service. So as an initial matter, to clarify, is the appellant abandoning her appeal to the extent that the board denied the 13 claims based on the veteran's first period of service?
Yes, we presented no argument as to that period of service.
And as to the 13 disabilities that are at issue, can you explain to us how invalidating the regulation on insanity would impact adjudication of those disabilities? For example, as to the two conditions where the board said the veteran didn't actually have a current condition.
So among the claims...
We'll add another 2 minutes. This is Judge Bartley.
Sure. Among the claims of Mr. Bowling included claims for service connection for diabetes and a heart condition that would be presumptively granted if his period of service, including boots on the ground combat in Vietnam, were recognized as valid because his character of discharge work was excused. And so providing him the opportunity, and again, our argument is not that these claims should be granted. Our argument is that these citizens should have a fair opportunity to know what evidence to submit and to predict what an adjudication will be because the discretion of the adjudicators has been reasonably constrained. For Mr. Appling, he has tinnitus that has been found to be connected to his service in the artillery for purposes other than compensation benefits. VA acknowledges that this is related to service. The only thing that is preventing his claim from being granted is the bar to benefits that he has not had a fair opportunity to challenge because of this rule. When you look at his hearing.
As to that, the board actually found that after Mr. Appling that there was no evidence that he had any psychiatric condition in service. And in arguments in your briefing, you didn't challenge that factual finding. So if that finding remains undisturbed, how does he show harm based on the regulation?
So our argument as to Mr. Appling was that he was denied fair development of his claim. How it would turn out on the merits is something we cannot know until he has had a fair opportunity. At his hearing, the VLJ asked only one question regarding his mental health condition. Did you know right from wrong? That's record at 34. Did you know right from wrong? And then that was the basis for denying it. There was no part of the decision that addressed whether the duty to assist was satisfied and whether he was entitled to development assistance from VA before the merits of his character of discharge was considered.
But your contention is that you didn't need to challenge those underlying factual findings, that he had no psychiatric condition in service?
We do not have to challenge that on the merits. We can challenge that for procedural inadequacy and the failure of the board to provide adequate reasons or bases. The fundamental argument for Mr. Appling's claim, as we've laid out about it, is he did not get fair development. The board did not consider whether he was entitled to development of his claim, even though he asserted at his hearing that he had mental health problems and that his superiors ignored them in service. And
in
when we
briefing,
see that
did you argue duty to assist in your opening brief?
I do believe that we did. I do not have the page in front of me, but that is the fundamental requirement. There are many different forms in which this issue can arise. It can arise on the merits. It can arise on the question of whether the duty to assist has been satisfied. It can arise on the question of reopening. But fundamentally, if a person didn't know what they had to submit in order to prevail, it is circular to say that they failed to submit it and therefore there's no prejudice. The court would have to violate the separation of powers by itself interpreting the regulation in the first instance to then create a standard against which it makes a finding that there was no prejudice. We are asking for a less intrusive situation where the court doesn't try to define this in the first instance, but gives VA the opportunity to provide a definition that gives citizens fair notice and prevents the arbitrary adjudicator lottery that we have at the RO and the board today, and then we determine what is appropriate, whether it's adjudication on the merits, further development, and most importantly, the opportunity of citizens to submit evidence that gives them a chance.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ridgway. I believe I heard the bell. This is Judge Bartley. Judge Meredith, do you have any further questions?
I do not, thank you.
Judge Salvi, do you have any further questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ridgway.
Thank you,
Ms.
Your Honor.
Ms. Murad, you may proceed as to class certification argument.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. There is a presumption against class certification, and that presumption should be upheld here. It's appellants that must demonstrate that the class action device is superior than the court's other available tools, and they may show that by a preponderance of the evidence. In turning to the second factor as to whether litigation of the challenge involves compiling a complex factual record, appellants don't rely upon their individualized facts at all. Their factual records are not complex in terms of the evidence relied upon to dispute the constitutional validity of VA's insanity definition. Their records instead exist only as a means to afford their place of standing before this court. In SCORE, on the other hand, the record there was complex. It was technical and voluminous. It related to technical and scientific matters related to urine dosage intake, air sampling comparisons between plutonium exposure cases. Here, appellants don't rely upon their facts. In fact, they submit some evidence and opinions for the court to review now for the very first time. As to the third factor, whether the appellate record is sufficiently developed to permit judicial review of the challenge conduct, appellants, like I stated before, rely upon argumentation and evidence submitted to the court for the very first time. In fact, they concede to that point in their supplemental memorandum where they state that they introduced global background facts about the mental health, character of discharge, and claim outcomes that were not presented to the board. Under Kim, the court should not consider the evidence submitted. In turning to the fourth factor, as to whether the putative class has alleged sufficient facts suggesting a need for remedial enforcement, appellants have not shown the need for remedial enforcement due class certification. They have not alleged sufficient facts suggesting that need. They have not shown that the composition of the putative class requires prompt remedial enforcement. They haven't alleged that the putative class members are of advanced age. They have not shown that VA has misapplied a regulatory definition that is, unless this court decides otherwise, legally valid. And they have not shown that VA would not regularly, as it is presumed to do, apply this court's precedential decision to all adjudications going forward. Additionally, a precedential decision is not only the most efficient way to handle this matter, it is the most manageable tool for effectuating relief. Manageability of a class is a relevant consideration in the certification analysis. The proposed class composition in Bowling is difficult to manage in terms of the identification of those putative class members, and that manageability is an issue that both the agency and this court will face should the court certify class. In their supplemental memorandum, appellants again concede that identifying and locating former service members will be a labor-intensive issue that will require cooperation. They cast too wide a net in defining their putative class, and that would impede the prompt adjudication of service members' claims. The sorts of regulatory challenges that appellants bring here should not be the types of actions that warrant class certification. Otherwise, all straightforward challenges to agency regulations may become mired in class litigation, which would lend to the use of the tool of class resolution as anything but the exception, and it is meant to be the exception. Appellants have simply not shouldered or overcome their burden in rebutting the presumption against class certification, and this court should use its existing tool, the ability to render precedential decisions that would bind others not before the court, and that effect is like that of a class action judgment. As appellants fail to demonstrate that the necessary superiority test is met, class action is entirely inappropriate. Now my colleague Christopher Bader will be addressing your questions regarding the merits of the underlying claim.
Judge Meredith, do you have any questions for Ms. Murad on class certification?
I do not, thank you.
Judge Falvey?
No, I don't. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Murad. Mr. Bader may proceed now.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The Due Process Clause is broad in its applications and aspirational in its reach, but this does not mean that anything goes in a due process case. No court has ever held that the legal rules developed under the due process label can be amalgamated into a single claim. Rather, due process claims have been carefully developed through centuries of precedent to protect distinct legal rights. Different elements must be proven to assert each type of due process claim because different rights are at stake and different conduct might violate each type of right. Other than citing an overruled case, appellants have not identified a single court that has ever recognized the untethered, free-form due process claim they seek to bring. Even more troubling, in their reply, for the very first time, appellants blaze at least two new trails in constitutional law without a single on-point authority to support them. First, appellants say that the court should more readily invalidate a regulation because it isn't as important as a statute. No case has ever endorsed this view, and even a cursory search reveals a laundry list of courts applying ordinary constitutional standards to regulation. Second, appellants say that the court should scrutinize this regulation more harshly because it provides a social welfare benefit. But here again, they cite not a single authority actually adopting that view. The Supreme Court has defined categories of enactments that deserve more or less scrutiny under the Due Process Clause, such as criminal laws, commercial laws, and laws affecting First Amendment rights. The insanity regulation can only be viewed as a commercial law, and there's no support whatsoever for appellants' view that they can import a First Amendment overbreadth standard into a case not involving the First Amendment. In fact, the Supreme Court has said just the opposite. When evaluated under the correct standard of review, appellants' claim flounders. First, congressional intent allows us to determine what Congress meant by the words that it used in a challenged law, but it does not follow that the Constitution requires a, quote, liberal definition of insanity consistent with some supposed congressional intent. The court decides what due process requires, not Congress. Second, this regulation is not unconstitutionally vague. The key point to remember here is that appellants must show why the regulation falls below the constitutional floor. Merely suggesting that the regulation could be better is not enough. The court, VA examiners, and VA adjudicators have capably applied the broad and flexible language of this regulation for decades. Only one judge in the history of the court has questioned the definition of insanity itself, and none of the evidence appellants cite demonstrate that VA adjudications are either unfair or inconsistent in their application of the regulation. Third, appellants cannot show how they were prejudiced by any faulty regulation. Mr. Appling does not challenge the board's finding that he had no psychiatric disability whatsoever, including alcoholism, at the time of his misconduct in service. Similarly, Ms. Bowling does not challenge the board's finding, based on a VA medical examination, that her husband's only disorder at the time he went AWOL was alcohol dependence, a disorder long excluded from recognition as a mental disorder for VA purposes. So the secretary is asking the court today to decline appellant's invitation to essentially fashion an entirely new sort of due process claim unheard of in the nation's history. Instead, it should apply recognized due process standards laid down by the Supreme Court and find that the insanity regulation satisfies the requirements of the Constitution.
Mr. Bader, this is Judge Bartley. Doesn't the fact that the board and the VA, I mean, we've seen a lot of these decisions in the court and seen them in JMRs. The board, VA, seems to be looking outside the actual definition of insanity in attempting to apply 3.354. Wouldn't that indicate that the regulation is fatally flawed?
Your Honor, I don't think so, and I don't know that the board is doing that. I reviewed the board decisions cited in, for instance, the Garbleman article, the Adams and Montalto article. I did my own searches, and what I have seen in board decisions is that they take a very broad view of what the relevant evidence is going to be to determine the insanity question, and they also apply the very broad language of the regulation to determine fundamentally whether this particular former service member had such a gross departure from the ordinary conduct we'd expect that we can say that he was insane at the time of his conduct. So the fact that the
Mr. Bader, this is Judge Bartley, mm-hmm. when they do that, are they often importing a kind of lay definition of insanity instead of using the definition that's actually provided in 3.354?
I have not seen that, Your Honor. More often I have seen the entirely separate question that I believe Judge Falvey touched on earlier, where, for instance, in Gardner, the court said, VA, you need to do a better job of training your adjudicators to distinguish the questions of insanity from willful misconduct. They often go hand in hand because you were discharged for your misconduct and now you're asking VA to excuse that based on your insanity. And they are very closely related but very distinct analyses. So I see that there are problems in that realm, but they have nothing to do with whether the insanity regulation itself is comprehensible. And I think that that's a very key point to remember here, is that appellants would have you believe that because those two standards are mixed up sometimes, there must be some problem with the language of the regulation as it pertains to insanity.
Oh, well, what about whenever they often import a does a veteran know right from wrong standard or an incompetency standard, or they add an intent, or as I said, they add their own little lay definition of, oh, you're not insane. Seems like there are a lot of different problems with the application of this rule.
I think that the first three that you mentioned, this mens rea sort of problem, the knowing right from wrong problem, those are instances where the board is eliding the requirements of the willful misconduct regulation and insanity. I don't think that that means that there's some sort of endemic problem with the insanity regulation itself. I see that the language of the regulation is broad. It contemplates a wide number of mental diseases that could lead to the sort of gross misconduct that we would expect from a person who is insane. But again, that breadth does not itself indict the regulation. That just means that it's broad.
And in your view, would alcoholism suffice as the disease under 3.354?
It does not, for essentially two entirely separate reasons. First, substance abuse disorders are excluded as a type of disability that can be service-connected. And
yeah,
second,
right, but excuse me, Mr. Bader, in 3.354, we're not talking about the kind of disease that would have to be service-connected eventually or even potentially. Right? But what was your second reason? I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's all right, Your Honor. I should have started with the second reason first. The second reason, and the more important one, is that as the OGC opinion explains, substance abuse disorders are not the sort of gross departure from ordinary conduct that would be acceptable as falling within this definition of insanity. That being said, it is not...
Mr. Bader, that sentence didn't really make any sense because, of course, we're in the regulation. It requires that due to the disease, the veteran display a prolonged deviation, et cetera. So it doesn't say that the disease, what you just said doesn't make sense to me. Why couldn't alcoholism be the disease that creates a more or less prolonged deviation from a normal method of behavior?
Well, Your Honor, you just have to look back at the OGC opinion, which I find to be a very helpful guide in discerning.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Bader. I did read that. I mean, we're not bound by the OGC opinion. I was asking for your opinion about the. So you agree with the OGC that for some reason it's unclear. Alcoholism could not be the disease that's mentioned in 3.354A.
That is my position, Your Honor. But I do believe that the OGC opinion persuasively explained that these sort of mental diseases that cause the gross departure from ordinary conduct that we expect from someone who's insane don't include these substance abuse disorders.
Well, that was their interpretation of that. I mean, the 3.354 says no such thing, correct?
It doesn't, although I would draw Your Honor's attention to the reply filed by the appellants where they seem to concede, after fighting it mightily in the opening brief, that whatever definition VA would come up with could at least include the precepts identified by OGC, that is, approving psychoses, however that's defined, as an instance of insanity and disapproving substance abuse disorders.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think that this leads to a really important point that the court should understand as it's deciding this case, is that there is this suggestion that the regulation is vague because we have empirical evidence that tells us that it's not working in practice and people can't understand it. But when you actually dig down into that evidence, you find that it really doesn't hold water. So when we look at the statistics compiled in the underserved study cited by appellants, those statistics, as I explained in my brief, have no relation to the actual language of the regulation. If we're talking about whether this regulation can be understood, whether claims are granted or denied truly has no bearing on that question. The Constitution does not require a regulation to provide that a certain percentage of claims be granted in order for the regulation to be constitutional. And similarly, it was mentioned several times that Adams and Montalto in their article said, well, the board really only allows psychoses to operate as instances of insanity. That's simply not true. And if you actually look at the Adams and Montalto article, they cite something like 3 board decisions to support that proposition. So if we're talking about whether even on appellant's own terms, their argument is that in the main, this regulation is not working for people. Three board decisions does not an empirical statement make. So I think that that's very important for the court to remember. The evidence that you have been presented with, to the extent you can consider it, is simply not indicative of a systematic problem with the language of the regulation being applied by medical personnel or adjudicative personnel.
This is Judge Meredith. Regarding that evidence, could you please respond to the appellant's argument that we could take judicial notice of all of the materials that were relied on that do not appear in the record of proceedings?
Your Honor, judicial notice is a very narrow doctrine as applied by district courts. It's not something that we had a chance to brief for you. Would be happy to provide more briefing on it, but it is a narrow principle. It's not merely that some material is not reasonably subject to dispute, and so you can consider that it comes before you, particularly in an appellate context where your whole standard of review is defined by statute as limited to the record of proceedings before the board. So I think that in this court, there's actually even less opportunity to take judicial notice of things that are outside of the record. I think that I would emphasize to you, though, as I had just explained, the far more important point is that this evidence doesn't really take you anywhere, even if you looked at it.
Well, Mr. Bader, this is Judge Bartley. In one of the cited works, this is segueing into Judge Meredith's question, but then again, departing into another theme. In the Exanity exemption, the author noted that no training was available to VA examiners on how to evaluate for insanity. Why is the Secretary not providing training, and also do they provide training to adjudicators?
Your Honor, I do not know the answer to either of those questions. However, I would submit to you that the need for training as to this regulatory definition has nothing to do with whether it's unconstitutionally vague. The only question we ask when we assess vagueness is we look at the regulatory language. We ask whether there are constitutional applications of that language, and then our inquiry ends. So whether other aspects of the adjudicative process need to be better developed, additional training for medical personnel or adjudicative personnel, is entirely beside the point.
Well, Mr. Bader, this is Judge Bartley. It might be beside the point in our written decision, but I think it's very important in terms of VA's overall undertaking as to how they deal with the insanity exception.
I certainly agree with you, Your Honor. I think that the point that I would like to emphasize is that much of appellant's briefing is spent convincing you that we should take a little bit here and a little bit there from various doctrines, from various standards of review, various types of claims, and that's what I'd like to push back on. I'm not forcing the court into a technical box because I want to be technical. I'm trying to make sure that the analysis is disciplined, rigorous, focused on the actual question before you, which is a constitutional claim.
Thank you. Judge Meredith, do you have any further questions?
I do not. Thank you.
And Judge Falvey, do you have any further questions?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bader. I'm not sure if your bell went off or not. You have the opportunity to sum up for a sentence or two if you like.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. I think I've covered all the points that I really wanted to emphasize for you today. I think that the last one I would make is just to bring you back to the idea that even if you found that this regulation was impermissibly vague, there's really no basis for this court to sit essentially as an ongoing commission to review VA's work as it comes out to promulgate a new one. Instead, this court and other courts reviewing executive agencies doing their rulemaking allows that agency the opportunity to make the fix and to allow someone with a grievance in the future to bring a claim. But that does not mean that once one person sticks their foot in the door with a grievance that it allows that particular plaintiff or veteran to just stay there and watch what's happening as it comes out. But beyond that point, I believe we've had a fruitful discussion about the other point. And so I'd ask just to reiterate that you dismiss both of these appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bader. Mr. Ridgway, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to make one point regarding the Secretary's argument on class certification, and then I have a few points on the merits. As to the argument of class certification, VA tries to conflate manageability with the amount of labor it will take to rectify this constitutional harm for all similarly situated veterans. And again, NEMER is our example here. Rectifying the problem in NEMER took enormous amounts of effort, readjudication of hundreds of thousands of claims, lots and lots of hours from the parties in order to identify those claims, but that does not mean that it was unmanageable for the court. The court set out a specific thing that had to be accomplished, and then the parties went to accomplishing that, and then the court was called in to referee when there is a dispute. If the court says, this is what needs to happen, VA needs to come up with a new rule, and then VA needs to run a search on its computer system that is validated by the parties to identify people who appear to have been affected and send them letters inviting them to seek re-adjudication under this new standard, that could result in a lot of work, but it does not make it unmanageable. The court would only have to come in to the extent that VA develops a new rule and the parties believe it is not valid for some reason, and there needs to be refereeing of that question. And similarly, in the adjudication process, if there's a dispute about whether we've adequately and reasonably and correctly identified the people who should be notified of their opportunity and whether those adjudications are proceeding in a way that is not arbitrary. So manageability and the amount of labor involved are not the same thing. The labor falls on the parties. The court's job in this process is to manage the disputes between those parties. On the merits, I have a few points. The first thing that I would like to respond to is VA has asserted that we are asking the court to adopt an entirely new standard. That is not accurate. What we are asking the court to do is look at an entirely new context, but the standard is as old as the Magna Carta and as the Constitution itself. Vagueness exists when there's pervasive disagreement about the nature of the inquiry. It's, as the Supreme Court said in the 1800s, when there is naked or arbitrary power to give or withhold a benefit, then due process is violated. What we are arguing is not to amalgamate a bunch of old standards to create a new standard. What we are arguing is we have a new context, and it does not matter which lenses you use to view this constitutional issue. It fails from every perspective. From the perspective of the citizen, it fails to provide notice of what do I need to prove for the government to keep its promise to care for me after I have suffered a disability related to my service. When you look at the perspective of the adjudicator, it fails because it does not prevent arbitrary and capricious decision-making. Counsel tried to explain that the regulation is broad and that the court and that the board does not apply it in a particular way, when what he really meant is it could be interpreted as broad, and sometimes in an unpredictable way, it is interpreted as broad. The Adams and Montalto point was not that the board only grants character of discharge relief when there is psychosis, but that is the only reliable fact pattern in which the board will consistently grant relief. Everything else is subject to the adjudicator lottery, where sometimes you get a judge who has 100% denial rate, and sometimes you get a judge who only has approximately a 50% denial rate, and you cannot predict the outcome or know what to submit until you've played the lottery. In terms of the argument, again, we're not seeking an amalgamation. This fails under the perspective of notice to citizens. It fails under the perspective of how the outcomes appear when you examine them. And when it comes to these facts, this is not a situation where there's a genuine issue of material fact, and the court needs to be cautious about fact-finding not having been done properly below by the body that needs to do fact-finding. The secretary is not presenting the court with any type of alternative evidence that suggests that the characterization of these differences is not accurate, that these decisions as presented by these reputable organizations isn't correct. This is an AZ situation. This is exactly like where the Federal Circuit went beyond the record in determining whether or not MST was being handled by VA and said, this is what we all know to be true. Nobody's really arguing that this is the reality of MST. We don't, as a court, have to pretend that we have blinders on and we don't know what's going on every day. We can look and see from the copious evidence, from reliable sources, this is what's happened. The question is, what do we do about it? And so ultimately, the arguments of the secretary are not arguments that this is right and the court cannot fix this. These are justifications for the court saying, we don't want to get into this because we're afraid of what might happen. Fundamentally, the secretary has not identified a separation of powers problem that comes from invalidating this regulation and saying the statute stands on its own terms. Everybody who could potentially and clearly get relief under the regulation can still get that relief. But what we need is clarity for the great majority of people who do not fall into the small sliver of people with psychoses or personality disorders. And I did a quick search last night on board decisions from 2019, and there were about 3,500 that dealt with psychoses, 1,500 with personality disorders, so about 5,000 that fall into the categories that are clearly addressed by the general counsel opinion, but over 25,000 decisions by veterans with PTSD and over 10,000 by people claiming depression, over 10,000 by people claiming anxiety. The overwhelming majority of cases that are seen by the board and by VA fall into this large area where we don't know what's going to happen. Could VA do the right thing? It could. Sometimes it will. And that's why this isn't just an issue of the regulation being invalid under statutory interpretation. It's not that VA is doing something consistently, and that consistent thing is not what Congress intended. Is that VA's outcomes are unpredictable. Sometimes you get assigned to the Boston RO and you have a chance. Sometimes you get assigned to Indianapolis and you have a 0% chance of winning, and you don't even know why, because when you submit a medical opinion that says he was not responsible for his AWOL because of what happened to him in Vietnam, VA says that's irrelevant. Even when you go back to the legislative history from 1945 and you see that that is exactly what Congress intended. And so it is not enough that it might be possible for the promise to be kept if you get a favorable adjudicator. We can do better. You know, under yet a different perspective of Matthews v. Eldridge, we can have a better regulation that provides greater consistency with no harm to the values that we're concerned about when it comes to separation of powers and judicial authority. And for that reason, the court should strike down this regulation as invalid, order VA to replace it with a rule that is valid, provides fair notice, constrains arbitrary decision-making, and conforms with the original intent of Congress, and then, as in Wolf, and as the Federal Circuit said, the court needs to make sure that this systemic error is corrected so that like veterans are treated alike. This is an uncommon situation because it involves due process and a word, insanity, that if left alone does not have a meaning today that is what Congress meant. And for that reason, under these unique circumstances, the court should provide relief to the appellants, Mrs. Bowling and Mr. Appling, and all similarly situated veterans. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ridgway. And thank you all very much for your argument. The case is submitted for consideration, and the court is adjourned.
This court is in recess.